Good afternoon. We are opening up the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. Today is May 14th, and what we have on the agenda today are informational hearings. We're first going to be visited by the Institute for Modern Government, and we're going to go for approximately 55 minutes on that conversation. Is that too much time?
No. We're trying to get it down to 7 minutes, but we'll fill
7 minutes?
No. Thank you.
I will give eight.
He's the big talker.
All right. Take as much time as you need, but by 2 o'clock, we're going to switch over to our Secretary of State Audit Division. So if you need less time, that is very, very much appreciated in this building. So why don't you come on up?
There's only two.
You must be Catherine?
I be Catherine.
Perfect, Catherine. And you must be John?
John DeFrank.
Perfect. If you two would just introduce yourself for the record, and then we'll turn the microphone over to you.
Thank you. I'm Catherine Weber, and I'm the CEO and one of the founding members of the Institute to Modernize Government.
And I'm John Dufresne, a more recent member on the Board of Directors, and a 30-year history with the State of Oregon.
Including?
Oh, I'm supposed to do an including, huh? Department of Revenue, DAS, auditing, internal control, systems work, and I finished my career as the Chief Financial Officer for the Public Employees Retirement System.
Okay. Do you want me to say?
Yeah, please.
Okay.
The floor is yours.
Co-chairs, Stainer Howard and Representative Smith. Members of the committee, my name is Catherine Weber. IMG is very pleased to be invited here for an informational overview of our collections project and the status of Oregon's accounts receivable. IMG is part of the Graduate School of Management over at Willamette in their Center for Governance and Public Policy. We believe that using Willamette law students, faculty, and specifically we have members on our board from the Graduate School of Management. We're using them in a research capacity and use both students and faculty. We have a volunteer board of retired state managers and a network of people we work with and have worked with in state agencies. All of this is dedicated to our primary mission, which is to modernize government. And if anybody ever wants a two-hour on modernizing government, we believe we understand a lot and have a lot of recommendations.
If I may, Mr. Chair, yes, I would actually like to sign up for that after session. Thank you. Please get in touch with my office.
And okay. Some of the documents I'll be referencing you have in your packet, but also on our website, which is www.instituteformoderngovernment.org. If you look there, you'll see a list of our board members and a number of other documents. Our chair, John Radford, unfortunately can't be here today. However, John is past president of the National Association of State Auditors, Comptrollers, and Treasurers. For 5 years, he's been trustee of the Financial Accounting Foundation, which manages the setting of both government and private sector boards that set the accounting rules and practices for the United States. And for 22 years, John was the comptroller for the state of Oregon during a large portion of time. He's been retired 4 or 5 years. John, in summary, asked me to, I asked him what he would be telling you if he were here. And he came up with 3 things that he thinks are critical, high-level overview of the issue. 1, state government needs a central point of contact to provide leadership, focus, policy, and management control over accounts receivable and collection activities across the core of state government entities. In other words, somebody who's the boss of everybody. State AR and collections is broadly diverse in policy, technical systems, laws, practices, intergovernmental relationships, and client and consumers. And if it's left to its own to meander, increase in collections likely won't happen. A central point of contact would provide a focus in the ability to coordinate, build consensus, and be able to measure and track process. Our vice chair is Gary Weeks. Gary was the director in Oregon of DHS, Lottery, DAS, DCBS, and I believe started his career in LFO.
And I believe he even had a moment or two on the Oregon Youth Authority as a fill-in director for a while.
Okay. And he was the director of the Department of Labor and Industries up in the state of Washington. Gary's message is that throughout his career, one of his primary goals wherever he worked was to find ways to make government work more efficiently, effectively, and produce good results for the public and the state. I still have that as a goal, even in retirement, and that is why he says he is proud and grateful to be a member of the board of IMG and continue to look for ways to improve our government systems. I mentioned them because I believe it gives us a significant amount of credibility. This topic, collections, even for those who've been involved in it for years, is incredibly complex legally. I'm a lawyer, A lot of this stuff is very, very complicated. Accounting, there's an incredible amount of complexity in that, and also in technology and operations of government generally. I believe that the process we've all engaged in and the expertise and experience of those involved gives credibility to our project. And one of the first things, just in terms of information, this should be in your packet, but what it is, we made the assumption that, and just pulled out of there, frankly, four staffers at DAS would be a good beginning to start the process of changing this collections thing. And across the top, the debt that's identified by LFO in your delinquent and liquidated accounts is somewhere near $3.2 billion. If the collection rate were only 1%, and if the cost of those four staff were $600,000 for a year, the ROI would be $31,400,000, or an ROI of over 5,000%. Professor Thompson, who is on our board, said that an ROI in the private sector above 10% is considering worth chasing. So this has gigantic according to that. And then we just ran some other numbers down here to see that same staff level and if the increased collection were to go up 5, 10, 20, whatever percent, that shows what the ROI is. The next part of that document is a summary that the group did of what the problems and the complexity of collections is all about. I'm not going to read all of these to you, but one, it's not viewed as a core function of many of the agencies. Another thing is that there's no good definition of what bad debt and good debt is, and this will lend itself to the exploration and definition. On the back, we have a graph. One of the urban legends in government has been that the significant increase in accounts receivable, liquidated, and delinquent was due to the recession only. And we took a look, and the professor helped me with this, but looked at across the top the increase in accounts receivable, and the Oregon unemployment rate kind of as a proxy for the recession. It was the best number that we could find. And then the middle line shows where 1.25 DAS staff positions were eliminated. John was at one point in one of those positions, and the downtrend is a result of that. There's certainly, it looks like there's a correlation. We're not even suggesting necessarily that there is a causation involved, but we wanted to address the, quote, idea that this thing will fix itself. We don't believe that it will. Okay. Let me just quickly talk a bit about what is in and what the project has been all about. In November of 2013, IMG held a kickoff symposium, which was co-sponsored by DAS, DOR, and several legislators. 150 people came. Presenters included Federal Treasury staff, Oregon Treasury, and we had members there. There's a list, which is it's on the second document that you have in your packet, and it lists at the front of it the people who were at the conference and the topics that came out of the conference that we have continued to work on. And one of the top findings that came out of that was that there was essentially a mismatch of state and federal government rules, statutes, practices, etc. So one of the recommendations that I'll talk about in a bit was that the one of our teams, called the legislative team, do a compilation, in fact, a basic inventory of legislation related to this topic. After the symposium, we started we believe that collaboration is a critical tool in being able to solve these, quote, wicked problems. This document that you have, I believe, shows the structure that we set up and the teams that we put in place to start to manage a solution to the problem. And the legislative team, and I believe there's legislation following recommendations, was done as part of this legislative team. Eli Justman, who was hired by Representative Berger last summer, he's here, and he put together the compilation of rules, et cetera, and then came up with a list to be drafted for legislative enactment. There were a number of other things that DAS has done internally, and John has been part of a kind of cross-pollinization. The director of DAS last spring, summer, put together a team of the DASians, including DOR and I believe the 10 largest agencies with the largest collection debt. John was and has participated on that team, and they have a fairly robust policy and action agenda, which is published on our website. The one of the other very active groups has been the private collection group that we put together. Mike Marsh, who's also, he's the retired director of DOR and used to a deputy director of ODOT, and he also used to be a BAM, head of BAM way back when. He's been leading a group to look at and develop decision criteria to answer the question, when should state debt be outsourced for collection and when it should be kept in-house. We've had some difficulty getting into data, but the group is progressing, and we're hoping that we'd be able to have access to data that we've requested. Another area that has not been activated and which we hope will in the future is the U.S. Bank and Treasury issues, which deals with point-of-sale devices. They did a very exciting presentation at our symposium where they described the possibilities and the tools and techniques that are available. Kind of as a side piece of information, I chaired the House Bill 4047 bill last summer that you all set up on customer satisfaction at DMV, and we got pretty heavily into debit credit card use. The Willamette students did a really good project doing the return on investment and on cost benefit for debit credit cards. It's about a 10-pager, but so that we hope to put in play at the time as one of our next phases going on. And then the rest of this is pretty self-explanatory, mm-hmm. or at least I'm not going to attempt to explain right now.
Okay.
So one of the what happened when Vicki Berger, Representative Berger, hired Eli to draft, that became a bill which was introduced through Senate Revenue, the Interim Committee on Senate Revenue, and I believe is now part of one of the bills before, which will soon be before your committee. DAS has also, as I mentioned, created a multi-agency group to follow up and work with us. Chris Couts of DOR is the chair of that DAS project, which John is on, and its charter and information is available on our website. IMG plans to continue our collections project. Our board is committed to work on this for the long haul, and we would be pleased to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions from the committee? Mm-hmm. Senator Whitsitt.
I was wondering, is that the total presentation?
That's mine.
John's going to talk.
John's got the detail.
Good. All right. John, you're up.
Here you go. Lights, camera, action. So as I was trying to put this together, I went back through what amounts to about 12 or 15 years worth of information. And I thought, you know, how can I put some context around the good deeds that have been done and perhaps some deeds that continue to need to be done? And so what I did is I went back and pulled slides, and you'll see oftentimes in the bottom right-hand side some type of context with the National Association of Controllers, with the American governmental accountants, and so on and so forth, so that I could bring context over the last 10 or 12 years and at least make some positive comments about where we've made some pretty good strides, and then I'm sure the Secretary of State will help us decide where we need to continue looking to make more strides. In 1997-77, there was 9 recommended actions. We began working on those immediately. One of the things that was the delinquent debt report. We worked with the Legislative Fiscal Office. In those days, it was Dallas Wayne, and helped kind of structure that, helped the agencies understand how that L&D LFO report would come together. Okay. House Bill 3509, which was brought to us by Neil Bryant and Jackie Winters, kind of set the stage for 2 significant new requirements. Assigning these debts to Department of Revenue and other agencies' accounts, which a lot of agencies have done, but arguably how well they've done it would be part of the questions, and the use of private collection firms. We also, again, began the reporting to the Legislative Fiscal Office and the legislature on an annual basis. One of the other areas we had was interagency receivables, which sometimes get gummed up in the work, so we set up some structure to help resolve any type of conflict between agencies. And through all this process, the Oregonian was trying to help us explain how debt was collected. We set up the statewide collection committee, which is kind of one of the things that is being talked about in today's environment, is why don't we get a return to the DAS statewide collection group. We looked at and have performed at least three, if not four, different business cases around the statewide vendor offset, and we continue. There's going to be continued discussion about that. We developed a statewide master collection contract. That contract was put in place and was also released through the ORCAP, which allows local governments to use the same contracted rates that we use. We did pilot tests for account assignments, trying to see how we can speed up the way the accounts go through, and particularly working with the other agency account units. We looked at legislative authority for greater sharing of information. With the exception of DMV, a lot of the agency information and the sharing is locked down by federal and state law. We looked at legislative authority for administrative garnishment. We had a little bit of benefits on that. We had a little bit of motion. And at the time I had this particular slide, online DMV access was now available through PC modem, by phone, and by fax, which is now more online stuff than it was in the good old days. We were exploring ways to improve automation and different softwares, different ways to connect, so on and so forth. And we had some successes there. Again, a lot of training, a lot of bringing in outside people or demos that would give them ideas how to improve own systems. Auto dialer system. There was a lot of discussion about auto dialer systems. And if you attended the conference that we had, there was discussion that the federal government was looking at this. At the time, we had a study put together. In fact, one of the leaders of that study was Lori Byerly, who sits right next door here. I was kidding her about this the other day. We developed this comprehensive report of how auto dialers could use, what they were costing, so on and so forth. Over the next few weeks, I was watching our web traffic, and that was the number one hit. And I thought, why is everybody looking at our auto dialer thing? And I went out and looked. We were the only one that had produced any type of documentation on the benefits of auto dialers. In recent discussions, I will tell you that I have been told that this is kind of like death by cell phone. So it's not as a productive tool as it once was. So in the original 2001 numbers, we saw a survey of the state agencies, and we found $1.8 billion in debt. There was $933 million in child support, $317 million in income taxes, $200 million in state courts, and $189 million in student loans, tuition, et cetera. A lot of the $189 million was at scholarship commissions, which went away a couple years later with regards to all that tuition money.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Johnson.
Okay, so went away with regard to all of that tuition money. Did they just walk away and not try to reconcile the accounts? Did all of the scofflaws end up getting the Irish sweepstakes? What happened?
No. Chair Smith, Representative Johnson, the underlying ownership, if you will, or guarantor of that was the Department of Education. So that is returned to the Department of Education, and I would imagine at that point they put it out to private collections.
Okay.
Do you have a follow-up?
I do. I guess they put it out to private collections. Had it reached that point where it could be turned over to private collections, or do we actually know what happened to it? I think the point that I'm trying to make here is that while some legislators have a tangential knowledge of the amount due the state, most don't, and I don't see a call to action or a sense of urgency, and every time the legislature makes some move, starting back with Senator Winter's early attempts, there's always some reason you can't get there from here. And I hope at the end of your presentation, what I'm waiting for is the call to action or the roadmap for the legislature to do something about this. Quit talking about it.
Chair Smith and Senator Johnson, I will have some options towards the end here. And
lovely.
I'll show you that we are acting upon some options. Certainly the ball's in both of our courts to try and say, well, here's some processes. I had a meeting with Senator Whitsitt a while back, and I said, you know, it's about processes, policy, and people. And we have to have those three components in place if we want to have a resolution. So I will explain that. I will kind of talk here, and again, part of this issue is around context. You know, how do we put some context around our numbers? So one of the things I put together, again, this is going back to 2001, was a presentation to show our accounts receivable, and we'll talk more about accounts receivable versus liquidating debt. But I wanted to compare us to Intel, Microsoft, Gannett, and Nike. And
One of the key outstanding numbers that's used to test your receivables is called average days outstanding. It's where you take your receivables divided by your revenue, multiply by 365, and you get that number. That's a contextual number that says, how do we compare? Well, we're 61. We're as good as Gannett, better than Nike, not as good as Microsoft and Intel, which have a lot more commanding environment. So, you know, we're not in a terrible place.
We've got a question here. Representative Nathanson.
Could you please back up one slide?
I hope I can.
Interesting.
The one before that.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. I understand that says partial detail. Did you get any numbers on how much is owed to local courts?
This was what was turned in 2001 based on a survey that was done to state agencies. So I can't tell you what judicial turned in.
Okay.
Again, state versus private, kind of an overview. The next is state versus the seven western states. Idaho, 22 days outstanding. Nevada, 73 days outstanding. Nevada wanted to offer me a job after I presented this information, and we found out 2 years later that they had to restate their comprehensive annual financial report for a material misstatement in their receivables. So, you know, this was starting to tell other states, and they were starting to look at this a little bit more formidable. And we had a number of follow-ups with a number of different groups with NASA.
We've got a question from Representative.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you. So since the source is the CAFR, I'm assuming that we're comparing apples to apples, that we're measuring the exact same things. Or can we guarantee that?
Chair Smith, Representative Nathanson, yes and no. So I qualify that because another slide is going to show you part of the problem in trying to do those kinds of comparisons, and that's one of the reasons I keep saying we need to look at the context. Okay?
Okay.
Excuse me.
Yep, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Smith. The this on the bottom corner here, it says it's 2001.
Yes.
So can you just kind of inform us, the reason we're laying this out is, why are we reviewing it? Just kind of getting a sense of why we're laying this out.
Okay, Representative.
And I want to make sure also the committee, I know what the CAFR is, and I want to make certain that my fellow committee members, I think Representative Nathanson does too, but we want to be careful about how we're.
Okay, Representative Smith, Representative Taylor, the CAFR is a comprehensive annual financial report.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's the state's financial statements, and every state has to do those, every local government has to do those, mm-hmm. and it should be put together under generally accepted accounting principles, so mm-hmm. therefore they should be relatively homogenous across all those entities. And if you notice, they use a lot of wiggle worms in there,
mm-hmm.
Because when we start comparing debt in particular, there's different kinds of debt.
Yes.
And I'm going to go into that here in a couple more slides.
But the 2001...
Again, this is the contrast. I'm trying to take you back and see this was the same problem we saw in 2001, 2005, mm-hmm. 2007, mm-hmm. and we're still talking about today.
Okay. Just want to make sure we have enough time for the Secretary of State's office and everything. Okay, great. Perfect. Thank you.
So on the contrast from Nevada, 73 days, we have Idaho, 22 days. So we followed up and called Idaho, and we said, how is it your receivables are doing so well? And they had this little thing called the Statewide Lien Registry. And so we went ahead and crafted some legislation and put that forward.
Really quick, before we move on, independent of this group, can you get me more information on that?
Independent? Yes.
Yes.
We crafted some legislation in 2005, and it's been circulating for a while. But that was how we dealt with the dichotomy, if you will, in how come one's so good and one's so bad.
Interesting.
So this is going to go to the context of comparability of debt. These are the seven western states just for taxes. So property tax, no, yes, 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 no. Oregon has no state property tax. Utah, no. Nevada, yes. We have income taxes. Washington, no. Nevada, yes. We have sales taxes, no. We're the only state in the seven western states. So when you start comparing, we don't have sales tax, they do. How does that comparison work? And that kind of goes back to the CAFR says taxes. It may not tell you what kinds of taxes, and that's where I keep saying we need to make sure we understand that we're, I use the term oranges to orangutans, but you know, to make sure we're comparing the same things. So, here's a slide, again, going back to NASDAQ in 2001, where I showed here's our receivables, here's our revenue, and the revenue's going up and the receivables aren't moving. 60 years ago, if you were in private sector and you had a slash like this, it said, why aren't you delivering more credit? We need people to have more credit so we can improve our revenues. You know, with credit cards and all the different terms of payment, this isn't as reliable a factor, but it gives you some context. Now let's look at what the most recent numbers are. Again, we're relatively flat. The receivables are not moving as quickly as the revenue. So in some respects, that could be considered a good thing. Again, I put the liquidated and delinquent accounts underneath the AR, so you can see there's a greater amount of accounts receivable, and then as they're liquidated and delinquent, they become those L&D accounts. Quick slide on just how the funds break out. This is in the text. I'm trying to move along and meet my time commitments here. So how do we follow the laws? And this is one of the areas where I have several sheets here that I'm going to kind of talk about. One of the areas where we say, well, why don't we do like the private sector? Because we can't. We have a great number of federal and state constitutional laws. I had a guy call me up one time and say, well, John, why don't we just put these people in jail? And I said, well, Article 1, Section 19 says there'll be no imprisonment for debt. So, you know, there's a lot of constructs around the government processes that are not seen in the private sector processes. Due process, it's all about giving proper notification, it's proper opportunity to be heard, and the purpose is to prevent an arbitrary use of government power. So again, the government's not supposed to be, you know, the big brother. It's supposed to be competing fairly.
You bet.
Upon achieving the due process, the account becomes liquidated. That's the definition of liquidated, when we've met our due process requirements. So this was a civil penalties model that I created back in 2002, just to show the context of how complicated it could be to go through the process of asserting those funds. The final process says, some agency statutes authorize civil penalties also require amounts collected to be deposited in the state general fund. Some of the agencies go, well, how come I'm putting all this effort in my budget going to collect money for the general fund? I don't get any credit cards for that. You know, I don't get any benefit. So those are one of the complaints we hear. Another thing was within 10 years of recording in the county clerk lien record. So the county clerk lien record, how many have gone in and looked at a county clerk lien record? They're great big books,
right,
this big. And they flip them open and they say, Joe Smith owes this money. And it's a very antiquated process. So those are the areas that, you know, make it much more complicated for people to find those debts. The Oregon Accounting Manual has a policy strictly relating to the Oregon Unlawful Debt Collection Practice Act, which is 646-639. It says all the private collection firms have to follow this. We should follow those too. Although technically we are exempt, but it's a good practice. Federal debt collection practice law is required for all state agencies, federal government, and everybody. So those two laws put together give you a pretty good checklist of how you should proceed in collections and be responsible to your customers. As Catherine alluded to earlier, there's so much involved in acronyms and terminology because we have the collision of the collections and law and accounting. So when we talk about adjusting an account, you know, you build the wrong amount, you adjust the account. We talk about compromise and settlements, which is one of the bills we have out there right now, is how do we compromise and settle? Well, that's saying we're going to renegotiate the liability for whatever purpose it is. Cancel, release, and discharge, that says that debt no longer exists. We're going to remove it from the books, not to be confused with a write-off. Bankruptcy, when concluded by the court, such debts are not uncollectible. Rather, such debts are non-existent. So that's the legal concept.
Question.
Write-off, a bookkeeping removal of debt, not a removal of legal liability. The next one kind of lays this out in kind of a matrix to help kind of explain this. One other asterisk here is the liability is extinguished when you cancel a debt, but depending on the type of debt and the type of situation, it could have some type of tax consequence. So, what is a receivable? It's an amount owing to a state, including accounts receivable, loans, nets receivable, and interest. Receivables can be due from any private person, firm, corporation, or others. What is an allowance for doubtful accounts? You'll sometimes see this as AFDA, allowance for doubtful accounts. That's a contra account in the accounting world. What that means is we're going to look at these receivables, And we're going to say there's $1 billion out there, but how much of that is really collectible? What's the fair market value of those receivables based on our history of writing off bad debts? And that's what that's trying to do, is bring those accounts receivable down to a level that says this is what we can expect to get. So when we look at the CAFR, we'll go back to that. It often is terms of net receivables. You have to dig under the covers to find out what the allowance for doubtful accounts is and what that net amount is compared to the gross amount. So I did that. When we take the CAFR amounts for the top three agencies, these three agencies make up roughly 85% of the state's debt. At Judicial, we see the CAFR amount is $1.4 billion. Their allowance for doubtful accounts is 76.95%. So if we use that number and apply it to the amount they show as the LFO accounts, the projected collections would be $320 million. So in other words, we're not going to get roughly 24% of that. This is one of the arguments I keep maintaining, that we need to do a better job of writing off the accounts. We need to clean off the books of the old records that are really not doing anything but making us look like bad collectors.
Yeah.
Again, Department of Revenue and Department of Justice, just to give you some flavors. So one of the things that, you know, that I work for John Radford, the former state controller, and he was always saying, what's the business case, John? So how much do you want to pay to get this money? And so those are the kinds of questions I'm asking here. What's our staffing? Do we want to compete with the private sector? Those are the salaries you'd have to use to compete with the private sector. Processing. I don't know if you've seen some of the computer systems that private sector uses, but they far surpass the COBOL systems that we have based on 1980s and 90s technology. I understand we're working on that, too. There's a lot of things to do.
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair.
Sorry. Mr. Dufresne, your point is very well taken about COBOL. We've been having lots of discussions here with the Department of Revenue about that very issue. Do you have enough of an awareness about the Department of Revenue's core systems replacement project to be able to comment on how that project will help us get us to a more modern place for debt collection than we currently are, just in that one area?
Chair Smith, and Senator Snyder, co-chair. I have been on the fringes of that because system replacements are a fascination to me. So I don't have enough information that I'd feel confident in sharing. I've seen a lot of the paperwork and stuff. I see a lot of the good things to do. But I'm one of these kind of pragmatists, you know. It's great to have a theory, but I want to see how it actually functions. I want to see how they solve the problems. I'd be happy to return someday.
Fine. Thank you.
So I will offer one other little piece of information here. The last time I did this research was about 2010, and at that time, 72% of global financial systems were still running COBOL. So, you know, when you have those legacy systems that are pretty insulated, that, you know, some people don't want to go with the cost of a multi I was going to say multi-hundred million, but it's basically you're talking about $500 to $1 billion to replace a statewide accounting system these days.
Yeah. So, can I interrupt for a second? IMG is looking at the net present value of replacing certain of the mainframe systems and legacy systems. We won't have anything for a while, but it's one of our projects.
That will be very helpful to all of us.
So I guess I have a question. I have a 101 question.
Oh.
I'm missing the connection between enhanced computer capability and collection enhancement. Help me bridge that for me. And I'm not naive on debt collection or finance or accounting, but in my mind, I can't bridge the two.
Yeah, so there's a number of ways you can get there. Number one is, let's say we want to accept payments. So how do we accept payments? Well, we make you go stand in line, use your debit card to get money out of the machine, take it to the person at the counter, and then have them pay your bill. Or do you want to go online, use a credit card? Be done like that. Make them do all the work. Make them go select their account and pay it. Arizona did a survey, and converting their DMV, the cost at the counter was 5 times the cost of online transactions. Mm-hmm. And that's a 10 or 12 year old statistic.
Yeah, I get that.
One, and may I interrupt, but one of the other issues is the whole thing about scoring debt.
Yes.
And to be able to triage the willing and able, the unwilling and able, the willing not able, and the not able not willing. And until that criteria can be abstracted and figured out for the different lines of debt, put into the DOR system, which I understand for the first time will have that capacity, you then send the debt through different channels. You don't waste the same amount of time on not willing and not able.
That makes perfect sense.
Right now, it's all down the same alley.
Mm-hmm. That makes perfect sense. Okay.
And to kind of add on to that, if you go to the high-end automated systems, they're doing that math. And they're doing other evaluations. They're doing mashups, and then they're calling you. And if you answer the phone and they know it's a live person, they're connecting you with the collector. So that would be a full cycle kind of automated thing.
And so if the state of Oregon was to move in a direction of making significant investments, what's the timing on the return on investment on that?
Which one?
That's the question.
It's very, some 10 years, some probably.
And we're talking 30,000 feet here, so we all understand. But yes, you're going to have enhanced collections, but I've yet to see a state of Oregon IT project that doesn't cost through the roof. And so at what point do you say the investment in additional IT is greater than the return you would gain through this efficiency?
And, again, that's where I quote my good friend John Radford, said, what's the business case? Not just the theory, not just the vision, but operationally speaking, how do you make those things? Mm-hmm. What's the process? What's the policy and the people that are going to have to go into doing that kind of work?
And I also believe if four positions or positions are available to DAS, that's the kind of a business case somebody dedicated to collections can, because it's incredibly complex.
Senator Whitsitt, you had a question.
Two comments, actually. One, I think that this debt collection should be centralized and it should be set up on an enterprise budget basis, a business case. And the other thing is your salary, your information there would be a lot more useful if it was total compensation, because your credit and collection clerk salary of $34,000 does not include $16,000 for PIB and about $7,500 of PERS and 15% of for days off. So, yeah, but other than that, that's all I have to say.
Thank you.
Okay, so we have 14 minutes.
Yeah, and I'm still shooting for five more. So.
All right.
Administrative, again, the cost overhead, what are you embedding into your costs? Are you adding interest and penalties and then giving those away? Because you're creating a lot of costs in your accounting system by putting things on and taking them off. You have to decide if you're going to do this or not. That's a policy question. Cost of hearings. In some cases, we discovered that the cost of going through the hearings process, which is required by the Constitution, was costing them more than the money being generated by the penalty that they were trying to resolve. So, again, cost benefit. And then on all along this, I'm always looking to establish and enforce adequate internal controls to protect the payment path from the payer to the bank. The average check is handled five times between the payer and the bank. So how do you make sure that it gets where it's supposed to? And then, as I usually add when I'm talking to accountants, some cash is mishandled only once.
Can I just ask a question, Mr. Chair? I know we're trying to move along. But
sure.
Do we have – I'm thinking about the cost of hearings issue, which I totally get, right, from a pure business perspective. I guess the other question is – where's the benefit in the psychology side of it, right? Do we have data on that? Which is to say, if people think that if they have a low amount of debt and they know that the cost of the due process hearing is going to be more than, likely to be more than their debt, does that encourage a certain level of scofflaw if we never pursue those ones? Or are we better off investing the money, as it were, to pursue them at least randomly? There may not be psychology studies around that question. There may not be data, but it's something I'm kind of interested in. I get your point from a business case in some ways.
Professor Thompson, who is on our board and is teaching over there, we've asked that question, and it comes back with a multitude of answers and nothing really definitive.
Okay, I'll follow up separately. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So here's one of the keys is how do we get banking? How do we get the funds banked? How quickly can we get those on? Do we use credit cards, debit cards, cash and checks? Cash and checks are slow. Debit and credit cards are fast. Do we process online or inline? Do we use, if we're taking checks, do we use check conversion? That's where you take the check, run it through the thing, it creates an electronic payment, and it moves to the bank faster. So we're not carrying these checks around, we're not handling as many times, and there's nobody's taking them to the bank, or we're not paying $300 a month for armored car services. Can you pay by phone? Mobile commerce, that's still coming. Some of the private sector is doing this. You know, that's one of the things that should be on the table. Interactive voice response. I understand some state agencies are still using that. That's a good methodology. It's slow, but it's viable.
Mr. Chair,
yep,
one other piece of this, and I'm channeling my colleague, Representative Gomberg, and that is by using debit and credit cards that the legislature is just coming to grips with. It took us a long time to use debit and credit at liquor stores. And we're using debit and credit cards, particularly credit, in a lot of different ways. I understand that some folks are allowed to satisfy their weight mile taxes with a credit card. We eat the processing. One of those accounts was upwards of $1 million. They get enough frequent flyer miles to go to Mars and back, and we eat the costs.
Senator Johnson, John Radford was invited to do some testimony, which has been postponed. He's looked at that exact example, and he basically said many of the debit credit card vendors, you just put a notation on there, good for payment up to $5,000. If it's over $5,000, you need to need another method of payment. So we can probably get you a better answer.
Right, but I'm not putting the onus on the credit card companies to say up to $5,000.
No,
I'm putting the onus on the state to stay.
Sorry, that's part of, I believe, would be part of the contract with Treasury or whoever is managing that flow.
Thank you.
Money.
I misunderstood. So we would only take it a single transaction up to five. Can I come back in and grease a credit card over 7 or 8 consecutive days up to the total of five? I mean, it's a legitimate question. When the state eats, if I recall Representative Gomberg's calculation, something close to $30,000 worth of processing fees. This is a pretty good deal.
And, in fact, it was Representative Gomberg that asked John Radford to come and testify, so I believe that will happen.
I'm going to skip this one for now because I come back to it. Whoops. So, again, debtor demographics, the ability to pay. It's one of the things Catherine was talking about, making sure we can put some context around. They used to do some analysis, to go back to Representative Smith's comment, they used to do some analysis in some of the scoring software that said, what zip code are you in? There's a higher probability you can pay if you live in Beverly Hills than if you live in Hodunk Hills. So those are the
careful, that's
things.
Our district.
Yeah, I was going to say, you just called it my town.
So anyway,
we're happy there, though.
This is some of the statistics, and this would be a good point. There's a recent article in the Business Insider that says this is what $11.8 trillion worth of debt looks like, and we are trying to return to the debt loads that we had in 2008. So that spells for some complications when we move forward. Whoops, hit the wrong button. So when we calculated, this was done back around 2008 when the 2008 split, and this is a plug for the Department of Revenue's Other Agency Account Unit. When we did this, we noticed that there's a direct proportional between the unemployment rate and state's collections. And what we really want to point out here is when the kicker was used in 2007-ish, it looks like, we were able to collect $42 million for state agencies from
Madam
that
Co-Chair.
Kicker.
I would point out that that exact same thing is going to happen this year because it's already been calculated and we'll be collecting a lot of debt because the kicker's going to kick.
So. When this stuff kind of happened, when I was over in the DAS building, I was sending out emails, get your debt to revenue. Get your debt to revenue. Some lesson. Oops. This is the most current numbers I have from unemployment rate versus collections. And you can see that 2013-14, as that date starts to taper off, we see the income start to come in. So we still see a continued group in there. So I'm going to really skip through this fast. So we have continued state support. We have 10 agencies we keep meeting with. We've identified Brian DeForest and Chris Kautz. They're kind of helping lead this charge. We're putting together problem statements. We're trying to develop what kind of expected outcomes. It's all really good to say, here's our policy and here's our practices, but what is it we're really trying to achieve? So we're trying to focus on that. We're trying to keep everyone involved. We even talk to Secretary of State once in a while when we have to. We do a lot of engagement planning. We're trying to consider, how do we communicate? How do we get the message out? We talk about the risk of not doing anything. Again, going back to that context of overstating, you know, what we think is even out there is liquidated and delinquent accounts. If we can get some of the write-offs in place, that will certainly help some of our processes. Central coordination, a work team that, you know, uses the enterprise model to kind of help solve these problems. Balances policy versus cost, going back to the business case concept, seeks to identify and use available resources. So, for instance, we have that federal TOPS offer, and we had them out last year, and they're talking about connecting up into their systems, and establishes cost-effective tools. You know, again, how do we do this faster, better, cheaper, smarter? We're working with the Willamette to do that scoring algorithm, to do better triage. One of the other things is we need to figure out, you know, if it's 25 cents or $25, what is a de minimis amount that is not worth our time to proceed? Using customer relationship management, CRM software, there's some discussions about how that might help, especially the smaller agencies. Modernize and diversify billing and payment processes. We come back to that over and over.
Representative Nathanson has a question.
Could you say just a bit more about what is CRM?
Customer relationship management. Mm-hmm. So it's a centralized software So from a debt perspective, you would have that debt tied in, and you would be able to track all the conversations that you've had, be able to identify any type of subsidiary information. You know, some of the private sectors use this to actually store credit cards and information, which I'm not advocating. But, you know, additional information will help when you're conversing with them, that you can be relating to them better on the phone and keeping track of all your concepts. Keeping track if they've made an agreement to make a payment plan and then miss that agreement. Those are the kinds of things. It's a centralized software to help solve those kinds of problems.
And Representative Nathanson, in Eugene or in Lane County, Professional Credit, Haas Financial, which is the largest professional credit collector the state uses in Oregon. We took our groups down there, and they have a wonderful walkthrough that shows you all of the modern stuff that's available out there.
Just makes me wonder how we're keeping notes now, like little sticky notes on paper files in drawers.
Mm-hmm. I would say across the board. I mean, you've got automated and you've got paper.
Okay.
Paper files. Again, trying to wrap this up. More assistance to the smaller agency, only they're like 15% of the debt, but, you know, try to get them going. One of the things that we've heard about is a pay it here, a one-stop payment process that could allow not only do you make your payment, but it would also feed all the accounting systems in, you know, again, reducing the number of people that have to touch the transaction. One of the things that I said, and this is back in one of my original presentations, is if we pay it here, if we don't create an AR, then we don't have anything to collect on the backside. So this is just kind of my conclusions. Any other questions?
And one last comment. You earlier asked, what can we all do to make this happen? The step that's right in front of us now is Senate Bill 55, and staff appropriately, the DAS function centrally, would be a big, big help.
This is a lot to absorb.
Yeah.
This is a lot of information. Greatly, greatly appreciated.
I guess, Mr. Yeah. Chair, yeah. I agree Senator. With you, even to the point where you're sort of just reeling from it.
Yeah.
We get into a legislative session, and we're so preoccupied by so much stuff going on. And I saw these conclusions in your presentation. They're not exactly the roadmap for dummies that I was hoping for. I know there's a pony in there somewhere. I want you to lead us to the pony. I want you to help us with some really specific recommendations. You are not unfamiliar with the processes of state government, nor are some of your partners. Chris Kautz has been around the barn a couple of times. And it might be helpful as we think about the February 16 session, but also ahead, to contemplate what might be a legislative agenda. Maybe convene a work group, pick and choose some concepts for drafting off of that. These are going to be complicated, so get the drafting started early, because what Ledge Council puts on the four corners of the page may not necessarily conform to the concept. And I'm just suggesting take us by the hand and give us some concrete roadmaps to improve our situation. I mean, you say improve automation. Okay, where, how much, what are your best thoughts on that? Streamline current business practices. How, what, who, which agencies? Is there a handful of pilot agencies that we could start with, or subsets of agencies that do collections? I'm thinking of the truck section of ODOT. I'm looking for that level of specificity. I don't know if that's beyond your charge.
No, I'm with you.
IMG is totally volunteer, unfunded, and we have one in almost a quarter staff that are volunteers, me and someone else. And we have been trying to be coordinating this, and we can maybe talk about a way to torque up our capacity, well, if that would be helpful.
Yeah. I mean, let me just make that offer right now. There are many of us in the legislative session who have relationship with private sector funders. Take a little bit of state money to help advance this effort, see if we could leverage it or match it with private sector investments. Many of the big foundations are now not just reactive to grant making, but they're actually looking to use their money in transformational ways, helping us scoop up $3 billion worth of uncollected debt would certainly be.
We've made five grant proposals that are around that. They have not been funded, but we'll talk offline about it, because we'd love to be involved in that, Senator.
Thank you. Just a comment on credit card collections. I would rather have 98.5 cents in my pocket than a dollar on accounts receivable.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be some top limit to that, but if somebody wants to pay $20,000 debt by four consecutive $5,000 deals, we've still got a lot more money than we had before.
Oh, I'm good. May I respond?
Of course.
I'm absolutely good with that, but I think some standardization. I think Representative Gomberg has put his finger on the pulse of how many different methodologies there are, and some guidance to standardize that would be useful.
Wonderful. We also may have interns available to do some of the work with legislative offices.
Do we have any more questions? I know I'm being rude to the group. I apologize. I just have to keep us on schedule.
Thank you.
We really, really appreciate this conversation. And I think with the Secretary of State's Audit Division coming up, it's going to help tie some of this together. And so we're excited to hear from them. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
All righty. Come on up, folks. Welcome. So we have 27 minutes, and the floor is yours. If you could just introduce yourself for the record and then just run with it.
Co-chairs, member of the committee, my name is Gary Blackmer. I'm the director of the Secretary of State's Audits Division. Let me give you a little context, then I'm going to hand it over to Jamie Rawls, who's the lead auditor on an audit that's currently underway. What we've done is a little different in this audit than we normally do. We saw the legislative session coming up. There were some issues that we identified that were really key around statutory and budgetary issues. So we felt like rather than issuing an audit report probably in late June or July, just as you're leaving, if we could pull out those pieces that we thought were most pertinent to this and other committees and do a presentation on that, with the idea that the remainder of the work we would continue and issue essentially, and it could be carried on without legislative involvement necessarily. So What we did was we pulled out those pieces. We put it through our quality control process to make sure that it met government audit standards, and we put together a presentation with some a number of key points. So Jamie's going to go through that. The points that she's looking at are those that are most critical to the legislative process. There are other pieces to it that are critical around the management of the debt, things that agencies can do just, and they should do, because it's a responsible and appropriate action for them to take. And that's essentially what the rest of our audit is going to be doing. So some of the things like streamlining or automation or training or coordination or better performance indicators are things that managers can do regardless of what you do and the statutes say, because they're things they ought to be doing. And so, you know, the 1997 audit had recommendations to that extent. What we're going to be issuing is more recommendations to that extent. But what I think one of the key challenges in all of this is there's a lot of money out there to be had, but it's going to take not just the managers stepping up, it's going to take some additional resources. And that's one of the challenges I think that, you know, we've always faced, is that we like the idea of collecting the debt, but we don't like the idea necessarily of committing resources to it, or it becomes the first thing to be cut. So that would be my key point I'd like to make in this. Mm-hmm. I'll hand it over, and then we have a few minutes for questions.
Chair.
Senator Whitsitt.
Mr. Blackmer, you've been auditing since 1997, you know, about six times. You have made essentially the same recommendations six times. Is it not required for the agencies to respond to your letters of audit to determine what they plan to do to reach your concerns?
Co-chair Senator Whitsitt, yes, it's they are responsible for responding, but they're not responsible necessarily for implementing.
For doing.
Okay.
So, well, Mr. Chair,
yeah, of course.
That's a really interesting point, Senator and Mr. Blackmer. Can you elaborate on that a little bit more? Because if they respond but they don't do anything, is that because...
It's a pesky constitution. The Secretary of State...
It's because it's a different branch of government.
Exactly,
it's
executive, and you've got the governor's office versus the Secretary of State's office. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, the co-chairs, it actually goes to our audit standards. Mm-hmm. We are not responsible for directing, because we become management. Mm-hmm. We make recommendations, and it's management's option to implement them or not. We try to build the most persuasive case. We make cases toward collections and non-filers and Department of Revenue. We make cases for better management of resources. And what we get is a good 85% implementation, but then a few years later, circumstances change. Positions go vacant. They don't get filled. Things just fall by the wayside.
Yep.
Follow this, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Blackmer, that brings up another question, which is, obviously, all the agencies you audit are overseen by different subcommittees within the Ways and Means world, and so it's not as if any one subcommittee. What role does the audits division have in communicating with the subcommittees that oversee these agencies and ensuring that the agencies are aware of both the audits? Well, three things: the audits, the initial response, and the ongoing follow-up. And how aware is the audits division of the ongoing maintenance of effort, if you will, after these recommendations are made?
Co-Chair Steiner-Hayward, we are actually rethinking our communication strategies and looking for ways to bring our audits to the committees that would be most interested.
That would be great.
We send emails out when we issue an audit, but we don't remind chairs 6 months later when they're having a hearing that you might want to ask what's going on with these recommendations.
It's prerogative of the chair. That would be phenomenal.
Yeah.
We would hug you if we got that information. Senator Johnson.
This was a vein I was going to tap as well. I think you ought to do your audit results of some of the big audits much more publicly. you put them into the pipeline rather quietly. It is only the most studious who can spelunk through all of this stuff to go find them. And I think occasionally a press conference to shine a little light. Oregonians seem hungry for a level of accountability. And you, as the stewards of accountability, I think you should have press releases, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Co-chairs, the Senator Johnson, I agree heartily. And one of the worries I have is that there is a disappearing species called journalists, and it's even harder to get the word out to the public and of what we're doing, because there's smaller and smaller newspapers, and there's less time to really promote those. And we're trying to make them more readable and trying to look at other ways to communicate it.
If you made the announcements in this building, the relevant chairs for the relevant subs that were looking at the budgets were there in the backdrop. It got out into newsletters. Nothing motivates either legislators or state agencies more than a little conspicuous external pressure.
Yeah, what they said. And you've got co-chairs of four subcommittees sitting right here. I mean, which of comp isn't at the moment. You've got education, human services, general gov, and transportation and economic development, all sitting right here, and we're all agreeing. Representative Kump would be agreeing if she were here, I'm sure.
Co-chairs, let me do one quick pitch then. In your mailboxes today will be our 2014 fiscal year ending state financial condition report. This is the only one we actually print, color, lots of charts. It's a 10-year analysis of revenues, expenditures, debt, liabilities, and we think it's a great way to display where the county, where the state gets its money, where it spends it, and it gives you insights into kind of thinking long term when you're making your budget decisions as well.
Yes,
I'm pandering to the chair, who we all know is a doctor. What is the condition of the patient, Mr. Blackmore?
Nicely done, Senator.
Co-chairs, we are in recuperative stage here now, but we haven't reached full health.
So the priest is still outside the door, hasn't gone home, but we're back.
But he's standing down for a cup of coffee. Yes.
And we need to get our health back for the next great recession, or hopefully just a small recession that comes.
We're
that would be the
well
way
can
I would
be
put
expected
it.
While on life support.
Yeah, there you go.
No longer on life support. We can step down from critical care.
We've got 20 more minutes, so
I will turn it over to Jamie. And
perfect.
Let
welcome.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. Thank you for having me. My name is Jamie Rawls. I'm a principal auditor for the Secretary of State Audits Division, and I am the in-charge auditor on this wonderful debt collection audit we've been undertaking. So I'm going to take you through, as Gary mentioned, this is a little different for us because we can't really speak publicly about our findings until it's public, until our report has been released. So this has gone through a process, and we're able to help by explaining at least some of the bigger issues, the big takeaways from our audit right now, and be able to communicate that with you guys now.
One thing that, Mr. Chair,
of course,
that will help me follow this is, who will your report go to? Because this isn't like a report of the Department of Transportation,
right,
where Matt Garrett is the obvious ultimate beneficiary. When it is as broad as this, who are you reporting to?
Our two auditees officially are Department of Revenue and DAS. Those are the two auditees that will be able to formally respond to our audit report. However, there are going to be, you know, our scope is the nine largest state agencies, the debt holding agencies. So it's they will all, if they are called out in any way in the report, something negative, something positive, we will run that by them as well. And Gary and I will have to talk about how they're going to be able to respond or not, but they'll be vetted through that process too.
Cool, thank you.
So it is a little different. So we are working on our performance audit. As I had mentioned, it's our sixth audit since 1997. So to give you a little history, about every 5-6 years, we come in, we do this collection audit. I mean, it always has kind of a different scope, but there is, I'll get to it in a little bit later, but there is no one place that can oversee the state's debt that we could go to even get a gauge of where things are. So it's like every 6 years we start fresh and have to go to all these agencies and talk to them and figure out where things are. Again, I'll talk about that in a minute. We began at the Department of Revenue. We did not set out to do a statewide collection audit. We started out at the Department of Revenue and then, you know, ended up that way through the course of questioning and just scoping things. We also engaged with DAS. And again, we're including the eight other, besides Department of Revenue, the eight largest debt-holding agencies. It'll be issued this summer, focusing on the improvement the state can make to increase collections, and we can deliver the final audit to the subcommittee. Overall, we do not see quick fixes. So I think that's the one biggest question we keep getting is, what's the one thing we can do to go collect all this money? That's the one thing we've learned that we can't do. It is multiple things. It's a multiple strategy approach involving a lot of small pieces with a lot of the agencies. There's some complex legal issues. In my 15 years of auditing, this is one of the most complex audits I've ever been on. It is very complex and takes a long time to understand. So it's taken three auditors almost a full year to get to where we are able to start drafting a report.
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair.
This calls for speculation, and I get it. Is that just the nature of this kind of beast, or is it that you have a sense that our state in particular is particularly messy and ugly, or is it because of the computer system, or all of the above?
All the above. But we, as part of our audit process, have looked at other states, and those that are most successful, they have a central oversight authority that, mm-hmm. that they can go to that knows the mm-hmm. lay of the land, that knows what all the agencies are doing. They know what the total debt is. They know who's gone up in collections, who's gone down, and we do not have that. So it's like starting over from scratch every time we do an audit. It takes longer. It's more complex.
Is that statutory that you have to have? I mean, would you have to have statute to do that, or is that something that DAS could just decide it was going to do?
We're going to be recommending that in the slides, is that it would take some statutory changes to put DAS into that role.
What's really interesting to me is when I first started in the legislature years ago, I had the paradigm that DAS had that authority.
Yeah.
And that was the lifeblood of state government. And the longer I've been here, the more I've come to learn that's not the case.
They do have enterprise-wide authority over a lot of things, but I don't know that they will be seen in that regard or taken in that regard if not tasked to in statute.
Okay.
Senator Johnson, did you have a question?
Oh, I was just thinking this has been going on now for almost 20 years, and there seems to be no sense of urgency. It goes back to my earlier point. What are we going to do about it? When are we going to do it? And how are we going to measure how effective we were in doing whatever it is that's recommended? I mean, you started this in 1997, and each time you go back in by your previous testimony, you're starting with a blank piece of paper. Plus, I would assume that that difficulty is exacerbated by what I refer to as blame the dead guy syndrome. Right. Every time you start with a new agency director, I've only been here 2 months. It was that other guy that screwed this all up.
Yes.
And we've been through, I don't know how many DAS directors.
For governor.
Yeah, it's more. I bet we've had eight DAS directors in the last decade.
Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, if I could interject. If there was actually someone responsible, you could ask them. As it is, you've got nine different agencies.
Yeah, and they'll go like this.
And bring them all up to ask what they're doing about debt is, I think, a little more cumbersome, and there isn't that central accountability that you can expect.
Armed with your new audit, it will be like a cudgel to get that information.
Senator Whitsitt, did you have a question? No? Okay.
So based on prior audits and the results from our current audit, we've identified some legislative changes that could help improve collections over time. Here's the four suggestions. These would be similar to our audit recommendations that have gone through our process. It is establishing a central oversight authority, improving performance reporting. Now, I'll talk about this in a little bit, but this would be the key that would help drive agencies to be accountable, make it a priority. Right now, debt is just a nuisance to some. It's not their key motivation on why they're here. It's not what they do day to day. But if you have a report that calls them out, good or bad, on what their performance has been and makes it a priority for them, it will spur that along. And so I'll talk to that in a minute. Address other agency accounts at DOR. Department of Revenue has the other agency accounts unit. It's a collection unit that was set up, and so we think there's some changes that could be addressed there to make things better. And then authorize state vendor offset.
What exactly does that entail?
So we recommended 18 years ago in the very first audit report. the state needs a vendor offset mechanism. So I know there's lots of talk about the Treasury offset program. That's the federal offset. An offset is, and so the federal offset is, we can send our state debt to the feds and they can offset federal taxes or payments that are going out to debtors. Internally, we don't have a process to offset payments that are going out to vendors, big contractors that we're paying. So if we have a state debtor, well, we can show you in our results. We have over 9,140 vendors of the state that are getting paid that are also debtors of the state.
Seriously?
Seriously.
Holy macaroni.
It is the prime place to capture debt very easily, and it makes no sense to be paying vendors when they're owing the state money. And we do not have a mechanism, and we reported on it 18 years ago, and nothing's happened.
We're getting around to it, though.
Yeah.
Representative Nathanson.
We don't have an administrative mechanism to do this in an organized way, or legally we cannot do it, or if we discover it, we don't ask for it.
Co-chairs Representative Nathanson, there is a common law, appears to be what is a common law that would give us the authority to do this. Department of Revenue has shown me that information. But because with the Privacy Act, the Social Security numbers and the Privacy Act around that is so complex, and DAS holds on to the vendor list, they do not feel like they have the authority to offset debt that the agencies may send to them from a vendor payment, because you have to tell the debtor when they give you your Social Security number, your Social Security number will be used for debt collection purposes. And if you don't notify them of that, then they can't distribute that out and therefore cannot make the vendor offset happen.
Interesting. Madam Co-Chair.
So I'm looking at Senate Bill 55 and the Dash 6 amendments to it, which I understand are the ones that got adopted. And I haven't read through the whole thing, and we don't have an engrossed version of it yet because it only got passed out of committee 2 days ago. But if this passes, which I sincerely hope it will it apply? It can't apply retroactively, so we'd have to go back and notify all of our current vendors. Do taxpayer identification numbers fall under this as well?
Right now,
because vendors usually have taxpayer identification numbers. They don't have Social Security numbers, right?
A lot of the vendor numbers are their SSN, or for businesses, it's their EIN.
Yeah.
And there is nothing prohibiting us. We could have been doing this for years on the EINs and have not been. It's only the Social Security numbers. And currently, we do not even have a notification on the contract that says, your Social Security number could be used for debt collection purposes. That'd be a great place to start. Submitting out to all of the vendors of the state that things have changed, your Social Security, by responding back, your Social Security number will now be used for debt collection purposes. That would then allow DAS to be able to take that vendor list and agencies to submit them to DAS, their debtors, and they could start doing that match. Or on the agency side, they could start doing that match.
Sandra.
Give me a sense of scale. How many vendors did you say there was? 187?
There was 9,140 vendors that owe the state money.
Yes.
I didn't hear that number. 9,000 vendors, people that are selling, I'm saying this for emphasis, that are selling goods and services to the state of Oregon, 9,000 of them owe the state money.
9,000 of them, yes, are on the vendor list. They have received a payment. They're on the current vendor list. And owe the state money. Now, our methodology only was very conservative, too. We only captured the debt that we could get from the Department of Revenue, the one place we could go that has the largest amount of debt at Department of Revenue, and then matched that to state vendors. And then there's timing, because you have a debt, and then you want to look and see, did the payment occur after the debt occurred? Mm-hmm. And we were very conservative with that, like looking out a year. Did the payment occur a year after the debt occurred? And in doing that, we didn't get as much money as we thought. It was about $1 to $2 million a year going back 4 years. So I think it would be, you know, if you actually had it in place, that other states have said they bring in about a larger amount the first year, and then it trickles down. But some states bring in a whole lot with vendor offset.
I'm just quickly trying to translate that into teachers in my school district. I'm quickly trying to translate that into I'd rather have 98 cents in my pocket than a buck. When you said there were no quick fixes, I not only think that we could drag in some immediate revenue, but it would certainly be an indication that there's a new sheriff in Dodge and that we're pretty serious about this.
Yes.
And it seems to me that all of these contracts must have renewal periods, and if we could get our act together this session, we could actually have language into the renewal clauses of the contracts that even if it comes incrementally over the whole spectrum of those 9,000 vendors, word would go out quickly, in my humble opinion.
Co-chair Senator Johnson, that's something that has been made case with other states that it's harder to measure, but there is that compliancy factor that they know if they don't pay their debt, their payment will be offset. And so there's that compliancy goes into place that we don't have in our state.
It was basically the question I asked about the contested case here. Sorry.
No, you're good. Representative Nathanson.
That's why I asked.
Thank you, Mr. Co-chair. I also was going to make the compliance point. I do have another question, though. To your knowledge, has either the Department of Revenue or the Department of Justice asked the legislature or a committee such as this in the past for authority to do this, and we have declined to provide this mechanism?
Co-chairs Representative Nathanson, I can't answer to that. I do not know if that's been brought before legislatures before.
Thank you. I wouldn't imagine you would necessarily know that unless you would just sort of come across right. It in conversation. But I do want to make the point to the committee. This comes up from time to time when someone, not these fine people, but when someone comes to the table and says, well, we can't do it because the law doesn't let us, and we remind them you are speaking to the people who make right. The laws. This is terribly disappointing to realize that once again there's something that if it had been brought to our attention, we could have taken action.
So I want to add a thought that I'm going to go mm-hmm. Representative. I don't mean this. Let me ask this question. How well thought out are the – do you have solutions for all four of those suggestions? Mm-hmm. And how well thought out are those?
Very well thought out.
Very well.
I've seen some great legislation pass in this building in 30 days, and I've seen crummy legislation pass in 30 days. To me, it would going back to the senator, if we have well-thought-out solutions being brought forward by our best and brightest, there's more than ample time in this session to move this forward. And on this committee, you've got three of the vice co-chairs of Ways and Means who could sit down with our co-chairs and try and bring solutions forward.
I just wanted to share with thank you, Chair Smith. I just wanted to share with my fellow committee members that I have started a conversation with Speaker Kotek about the establishing the central oversight and about the vendor offset. The vendor offset, we have known it comes up in other audits. It comes up in other conversations. It's something that I've been aware of in the past. And so those two areas, not the other ones, but those two, I have started a conversation with Speaker Kotek on them. But it'd be great to have additional support, though. So.
Excellent. Senator.
Senate Bill 55 is a vehicle that could be put in. It's probably coming your way pretty soon.
So
we don't have to start something new. You could actually get stuff in that.
That's the thinking, yeah.
And make it work. And if I could make a request, we're running out of time. And Jamie has more to say, believe me, than we could hear in 3 to 5 minutes. And I would love to see it rescheduled for another half hour.
Here's what I was going to suggest. Let me visit with my co-chair, because I think we would love to have them return.
Oh, we would be more than happy to have you come back.
If that would be all right.
We appreciate your willingness to take the time to work with mm-hmm. us on this, and we're going to ask for a little bit more of it.
Senator.
Just to push this point of urgency, I would respectfully ask the chairs of the committee to provide drafting authority and get the amendments underway to put into Senate Bill 55 so that there's no possible way that we can miss this opportunity, at least on these two issues.
I think what we're visiting with John here, I think we're going to be visiting with the co-chairs.
Yes, we are.
And we're going to take the necessary steps.
Yes, we are.
Yeah. Representative and then representative.
Mr. Co-Chair, if anything comes up in the drafting process to pursue these or other ideas that we're advised by legislative counsel that due to something with a relating to clause, it can't go in that bill, I'm happy to volunteer one of mine.
Awesome. Wonderful. Thank you so much. Representative?
I was just going to say, I was already thinking about for the, that I have priority bill that I can use if necessary. The vendor offset for 55, have you looked into that, Jamie? Is that, I don't know, is that work for that one or not?
It does. We've actually provided testimony. This was kind of just modified for you folks.
That was the one that I
wasn't
sure.
But I think there is pretty good language in there right now on the vendor offset and addressing other agency accounts at DOR. There's pieces for an oversight authority. It may not be as strong as what we would have liked. And then there's really not the piece on the performance reporting, but there's pieces of it in the current Senate Bill 55.
So just to be crystal clear here, have you two looked through what's going to be the current version of 55 after the amendment's done? And is there more that you think we can get through this year that's relevant given what you have? And if so, could you please start getting us some language? Because I can't guarantee we can put everything in there that you want, but you're going to know better than us what needs to be in there. Is that a fair statement, Mr. Co-Chair?
Of course, yeah.
Thank you. I can't make you any guarantees, but I'd love to see any suggested language, and from Representative Taylor and Senator Whitsitt as well, given all the work you've been doing on this.
I was just going to thank you, Co-Chair. I was just going to volunteer to help be the conduit for that if you want, but it's up to you.
We'll figure it out. We'll fund it. I would say funnel everything to Mr. Borden at this point for starters, because he can keep us organized here, and it's always easier. But we can figure out how to make this happen. But we'll prioritize this.
Great.
Whitsitt.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. As my reading of the -6 amendments to Senate Bill 55 on the Social Security number issue pretty much makes that a voluntary only. It's prospective and voluntary. Is that sufficient?
Co-Chairs, Senator Whitsitt, I believe that provision of a Social Security number must be voluntary under federal law.
Yeah.
So but they wouldn't necessarily get business.
I asked the wrong question.
Yeah.
Okay.
You can use
Senator Johnson.
EIN.
Two things. The first one is we could develop some kind of a certification that could be tracked backwards, and if somebody prevaricates on a certification, then we've got a cause of action. That's the first comment. The second comment is we've been unable to grapple with some of the big issues in this session. It's unlikely we're going to get a transportation package at this point. I believe that this debt collection reform could be a signature accomplishment of this legislative session. And you've had the benefit of some bipartisan and bicameral thinking here. And I honestly think that this could be one of the things this session is remembered for.
Quite well taken, Senator.
And so we owe thanks to Representative Taylor and Senator Whitsitt for helping to orchestrate all this to bring this forward.
Yeah.
And we really appreciate the best and brightest coming from the Audits Division. We are blessed by the good work you folks do, and we have been for years. So thank you for all you do.
Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair and I will be coordinating with John to find a time to have you come back, if that would be all right.
Great.
And we'll figure out how to put this all together and continue forward. We will need to visit with the co-chairs and coordinate with them, but I have to believe we'll be seeing progress.
Convey our sense of enthusiasm.
I will.
Our bipartisan, bicameral sense of enthusiasm.
All right, colleagues, I've kept us over 2 minutes. I apologize for that. John, is there anything we need to think about?
Co-chair members of the subcommittee, no. On Monday, you'll begin with the state treasurer's phase two presentation.
Perfect, perfect. Julie, anything we need to think about?
Yeah.
We're good? Colleagues, any last thoughts? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I also want to thank the folks from the Institute for Modern Government. Thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate this.
All right, colleagues,
we are going to adjourn for the day. We really appreciate this.
Thank
All right,
you.
Colleagues, we are going to